Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. Agent Rob Santoro breaks down what it takes to put together a gang case in this episode, how this gang evidence is important, and why gang prosecutions make communities safer. What he can't answer, and spoiler, I can't either, is why prosecutors shied away from the mountain of gang evidence in the case of Quezon Lee. Tune in to see if it makes sense to you. And welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I, again, have with me, and I'm ecstatic that he was able to make time for me, Agent Santoro. And we are here to talk about the gang aspect of this case on Quezon Lee. And I want to just give a shout out. Some of my listeners had reached out and they were very upset that we left it on a cliffhanger the last time. And so they've been asking me, like, when's the next episode? And here it is. Here, we got it. But I know that you are very busy. So
I didn't know you were getting pressure and static about it, man.
You know, people that you know have been giving me a hard time. Sharing. But we left off with that initial investigation of the murder of Hakeem Clark, and you had picked it up and you had, you know, found the evidence involving the murder that pointed to Quezon Lee. But in that process, you found a bunch of other stuff. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's probably an understatement.
So I've already, like, referenced the gang. How did you discover that Quezon Lee was in a gang?
Kind of like as these things tend to happen, as you're working violent crime cases, gang aspects tend to just kind of surface themselves if it's relevant, right? I mean, with Quezon Lee specifically, it was pretty apparent very quickly that this was a part of his life, because he was very young and he was very open and bragging about it on his social media and things like that. Even open source, which is, you know, just publicly available. Like, you go on Facebook and you look him up and you see he's making gang signs and claiming his gang and all this kind of stuff. So for him specifically, it was very early on and that I realized this, and, you know, it may be important to the murder, it may not be, right? So it kind of depends. But regardless, once you become aware of that as an investigator, you have to explore that. And what I found with Quezon Lee and his group was that they were proliferously violent. And it was pretty shocking, the depth that I uncovered some of the stuff that they were doing. And it became a huge vein of the investigation.
So I kind of want to jump in. There were two things that you've mentioned that I think are important. Like you said, it was obviously he was involved in a gang and he was open about it, making gang signs. Having been on the other end of it, and I'm sure you have as well, there's this idea out in the universe that, you know, gang signs or symbols or, you know, a lot of these words and things are just, you know, like kids doing kid stuff, you know, that they're just, you know, like in a club or, you know, like they've got a little tree house in the backyard, that kind of thing. You know, they is downplayed a lot, like rap lyrics that reference gang stuff. Oh, it's just a song. It's not something that's real or part of their life. How do you tell the difference when you see it?
I think it's kind of like through the investigation, right? Like, you have to look at, And I mean, I would agree with you, and I know that we'll end up talking about, like, sort of the statute, the governing law behind it, and sort of what's needed legally to prove criminal gang activity. So it's not just as simple as looking at his social media and saying, oh, he's throwing up a sign, he's in a gang. Like, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about organized groups that have at least some kind of semi-structure, that commit crimes and it can be even loosely organized. I mean, we're talking about, you know, probably 13 to 16 year old kids at this point. So it's not like, they're committing like really sophisticated things, but they're acting as a group for the benefit of the group. They're sharing weapons, things like this. But to answer your question, it's like you have to go into the information. You have to conduct interviews. You have to do warrants on the social media, cell phones, all of that stuff. You have to look at the communications. You have to understand what they're talking about. And when it transitions into that legal threshold where yes, they are organized as a group. There are clear people with authority within this group. They are committing criminal acts in the name of this group. Then it becomes not just a club, right? It's no, these people are a criminal enterprise. And what I found in Savannah, a lot of the younger groups especially, they weren't really doing it to make money. Yeah, they were committing robberies and things like this and breaking into homes and cars and all kinds of stuff. But it had a lot more to do with status, and status was achieved through violence. So some of these groups were contributing to a significant percentage of violent crime in the city, comparatively. So we're not just talking about kids hanging out and just calling themselves a name. We're talking about, these kids are out here hurting people.
Right. And one of the other things that you mentioned is that the gang evidence you were seeing, the gang information you were finding, may or may not have something to do with the murder. What do you mean?
Just because somebody is in a criminal gang, a criminal street gang, doesn't necessarily mean that that was a gang act, like for a specific crime, right? Like if, for instance, a gang member has a domestic dispute with their wife or their girlfriend, and they beat them up or whatever, the fact that they're in a gang doesn't necessarily mean that's why they beat up their wife. Now, if they beat up their wife or their girlfriend because they were with an op, right? They were seen walking down the street with an op, and that was the reason, then that would be a gang relevant crime.
What do you mean by an op?
Like
Use them.
a opposing gang member. So like,
Okay, sorry.
if you think traditional Crips Bloods, right? Like if I'm a Crip and my girlfriend or wife's walking down the street with a blood and then I beat the shit out of her because of that, well, that's a gang crime. But if we're just having a dispute because, I took her phone and she called me an asshole and then I beat the shit out of her, like that's just because I'm in a gang doesn't mean that that's a gang motivated crime. So you have to tie the crime to the gang in a specific way. It's got to be what they say legally, like in furtherance of the gang, or there's a bunch of legal, I think, terminology with respect to Georgia. Every state's gang statute reads relatively similarly, but there is some different language in there. So there's different things that in furtherance of, or for the benefit, or in association with the gang, like that's what makes an act, like a criminal act, gang related.
Right. And we are going to talk about the statutes. I was going to wait to get into like the nitty-gritty with that later, but I think you've summarized it really well. One of the things you mentioned though is like in a domestic violence situation, if it's not in furtherance of the gang, it can still affect things. Like if your domestic violence victim knows that boyfriend's in a gang and he's, hit her over something else, it can affect whether she's willing to come forward. Right. And whether she's willing to come to court and testify and those kinds of things. So it can lead to intimidation of witnesses and those kinds of things. Now, you've got to document it, you still have to prove it. But it's something to take into account when you are dealing with, various victims of crimes and things like that.
Yeah,
So.
and like, there's also like several indicators that are like, things we look for that indicate, I call them indicators, right? And I'm saying using the verb indicate, but that like their criteria, gang criteria. So like admission into a gang is one of them. Like, I'm jumping to another case, but when I was on patrol, I got into there's one kid that was banned from this apartment complex. I got into a foot chase with this kid, arrested him. He had like a red flag hanging out of his back pocket, and I just asked him like, "Hey man, like, are you a blood?" And he was like, "Yeah." And I mean, I didn't charge. I just charged him with the trespass. It had nothing to do with that. But like, I documented in my report that he admitted that he was a blood. So that's gang criteria, right? You can't just like say, "Oh yeah, he's in a gang because he hangs out with this group." It's like there's certain things that you need to meet as a threshold, and admission into a gang is one. Or like if a wife or girlfriend's like, "Oh yeah, he's a gang member of this set or this gang," like that's another like valid method of like identifying gang criteria for a specific individual. So yeah, like there, like not only can it affect it later on, but it can affect it in the moment. Like if she's pissed and identifies him and admits, yeah, he's a gang member, well, like that should be documented by like a patrol officer or an investigator. That way it can be used as gang criteria later on. Although that specific incident may not have been, you can still use it as a reference for, you know, gang criteria establishing this guy as a criminal street gang member.
So when you're looking at and you're getting it back to, and I know you've run into a lot of gangs over the years. And did that start primarily? You said you ran into this one guy on patrol. I mean, did that start like from the rip for you, run into that, or how'd that work out?
Yeah, you know, I'll say that I probably came across it less on the street in patrol, probably for a number of reasons. Number one, I probably was, you know, I was young and didn't know as much about the stuff then. But number two, a lot of times what you're seeing is as a patrol officer, you're kind of like responding to calls and you're dealing with the immediate problem. You're not really going into the depth of what's really going on. Sometimes you do, but not mostly. So, you know, that was just something that there was one of my good partners, Matt Smith. He and I worked together on a patrol watch, and he's a really smart guy, and he had a really good influence on me as a patrol officer. I don't know that I talk about him enough, but he was in the Marine Corps, a captain, just really smart guy. And he was like, "Oh man, you know, like this is good. We should document it." And I'll say, like, I'll give him some credit for that, because he was kind of like, he wasn't with me for the foot chase, but he showed up, you know, to back me up when I was running and stuff like that. And long story short, to answer your question, is I came across it more in the violent crime stuff, just because it seemed to drive a lot of investigations that we were conducting. And I mean, it ebbs and flows, you know. These groups, they come and go, or they splinter and then war with each other, and then, you know, a bunch of people will go to jail or prison, and it stops for a little while, and then a new group forms. So it's always changing. And I think that's one of the biggest things too. You have kind of overarching gangs that a lot of people are aware of in this country, but there's a lot of like neighborhood stuff that's very transient and changing, and especially with the younger kids.
So tell me about like what you were seeing with Quaison. You know, the first thing that you got of his that had those gang references would have been what? The Facebook or?
Yeah, I think a lot of it came from some of the social media, the Facebook stuff, especially back then. And I think we've talked about this before a little bit, and I know we mentioned the Rollin 60s last time with the newspaper article about Hakeem's murder, and that was in 2016. So again, it's like these things change, right? So if you go back into 2014, you're looking more at like a group that's called YNIC, that was a bunch of 13, 12 to 14-year-old kids. And it was a very large group. And then that group splintered into OTM, OTF, and like the Grimy Boys, or 1100, what became 1100. And so there were three groups that splintered out of that. So it was early in 2015 that the first kind of references to OTF, and that would have been Quaison's splinter from YNIC. Because if you look before that, he's claiming that. So, like, I can't say in 2015, right, that he's a YNIC gang member, because that really no longer existed anymore. So you have to be
Correct.
relevant to what you're investigating. So it was really in January of 2015, I saw the first kind of social media post where they were starting to claim OTF. A little more into that year, you kind of see more of like a solidification of like the founding four members, and then they started making shirts and all this kind of stuff. And then you kind of see a lot more of the traditional gang stuff where with the signs and the shirts and the clothes and the hashtags on the social media going into early 2015 into mid 2015. So like around the time of the murder, that's I would say 2015, mid 2015 was kind of the height of that. And then into the later half of 2015 it, as well. But then you started getting some of the members were getting arrested for armed robberies and shootings and having to go to either juvie or big boy prison
Right.
for these types of things, where then things changed again. And that's why we see into 2016, Quezon is more looking to like get into rolling 60s because he's some of his buddies, right, that are in OTF, like they're gone now. So he's kind of out there and looking for the next thing or to supplement what he's already still got with OTF. So that's kind of what I found in a summary.
So OTF, you said the YNIC, which again, yeah, I don't even know what that's supposed to stand for. Splintered into OTF, OTM, and Grimy Boys that later became 1100. Was that just like you could tell that they were friend groups? Were there social media that showed that they started to have conflicts with each other? What were you seeing that showed that that had fallen apart?
Yeah, it was like a little bit of both. And it was kind of a conglomeration of a lot of stuff, you know, like police reports documenting fights and things like that, BOE reports, social media, even some of the other investigations that we had done. Alan Sammons had an investigation in early 2015 where a kid named Anthony Crawford was killed, and he was part of that sort of grimy boys. And so like we started to learn about some of that during that investigation. And it's just like cumulative knowledge that you research it and you investigate it, but it's also cumulative knowledge from like the shit you're working.
Right.
And so we kind of started to understand, all right, like YNIC used to be a thing, and it stood for young niggers in charge is what it stood for. And at some point somebody shitted somebody else over a gun. And then you get this splintering and this infighting, and then they just break apart and then they start shooting and killing each other and stuff like that.
So there's just a lot going on here, but one of the things that I'm hearing from you is how important it is to document, 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 right?
Yeah.
And you did that with OTF and Quezon for sure.
Yeah.
So I'm just, giving you a shout out. I looked at your timeline of important events for OTF, which primarily I think focused on a lot of the Facebook stuff that was going on at that time, although it's beautifully put together with police reports and ShotSpotter and all of these things. How often does that happen? Like, I mean, I know you do it as far as putting together a timeline of what's happening with this gang. I didn't see that happening a whole lot with a lot of other investigations. So where's the disconnect there?
You know, I don't know. I have like ideas and thoughts on it. I think, you know, a lot of times when you get group violence and stuff, I think the traditional law enforcement response was to like, let's set up a task force and, you know, let's get the ATF out here and we'll do some shit with guns and drugs and we'll arrest a bunch of people. And you make kind of like a standalone case. I didn't see a lot of that going on with the violent crime unit. Well, I saw none of that going on with the violent crime unit when I first got there. And
So none of
even,
the gun and drug interdiction is going on when you were.
no, gun and drug interdiction was happening. Like that
Okay.
stuff was happening. But
Okay.
on the violent crime side, where we were working, the murder side of stuff, like I never saw like real extensive gang work going into that. It was strictly bare bones, like you worked the murder, and nobody, to my knowledge, delved too far into any kind of gang aspects. And not that they didn't exist, right? You had HVP and all these other groups that existed before my time there.
It's Village Posse forever. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, like, I think they existed, but on like the homicide violent crime side of the house, that wasn't something that was really ever made part of like the murder investigations to my knowledge. I know it doesn't happen up here. Up here, it was kind of like gang. You mentioned the word gang, it's almost taboo, and it's, I don't know. There, it's just a weird concept to me for people not to either acknowledge. And I think, was it Lovett that said that we don't have a gang problem? I think he said he was a chief when I was there. Savannah doesn't have a gang problem, and it's like, well, yeah, we do, but
We're
so for
just
a long
ignoring
time,
it.
it wasn't even acknowledged, so like, why investigate it if it's not being acknowledged? And especially if you're getting political pressure from internally within your department of like, no, we're not working gangs, we're not doing this, or we're not doing that. We're just going to do a traditional drug and gun task force response or whatever you're going to do, which, in my opinion, is not super effective. It can be temporarily effective, but what you really want is to get the guys on the violent crime stuff if you can.
So it's labor intensive, bottom line, to
It
put
is,
all of
yeah.
this
It
together.
is because, yeah, it takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time.
And
And
if you're
you're
short
writing
on
lots of
manpower,
warrants.
you
Right,
know,
right. Yep.
yeah, it's just not a priority. But at the same time, I want to talk about the manpower that you put in for Quezon. Tell me what you started seeing with him.
So like I just saw like I said, prolific criminal activity. Almost like, I mean, you could reference a police report or something in social media, like almost weekly with him, where you could pull something up and say, oh, look, he's claiming he did a shooting this week. Oh, he robbed somebody this week. He broke into a house, stole a gun, stole a car, was arrested. And it was like, so there was a lot of volume there. And so the first thing I kind of started to do, I was like, well, like, there is a lot of criminal activity here, but it's going back to what we started talking about. It's like, all right, like, can I establish this as a gang? Like, okay, they're saying OTF and doing all this crap, but like, the first thing I need to do is establish that a gang exists, and it exists legally within the statute and what that means. And so I went to dropping warrants on like all of the other gang members' social media. So I was getting like lots of account information. I was working with some of the cell phone data that I had and police reports, and I started just kind of building, yeah, like a timeline, of what was happening when and what they were saying about those incidents. So it's like what you can prove, what you can corroborate, because there were times where like his friends might get arrested and he was there, but they just, like in the reports, it says another unknown black male fled and wasn't apprehended. And then you go to the social media, cross-reference it, and he's saying, oh yeah, I was with Naquan, and Naquan was the one that got arrested. So then, he's claiming that he was that other person during that crime.
Right.
And so you just start piecing all those little things together. And I was able to establish like the gang existed. It was able to meet that criteria. I started identifying all the people, because some of it started, I might just have a social media handle. And it's like, all right, this guy's claiming OTF. Like, who's this person, right? And then you got to identify who that is. There's a lot of identification going on. There's a lot of like cross-referencing different sources. And to your point, yes, it takes a long time.
Well, so from a, and you talked about the criteria, like what is a gang? And I pulled up the statutes because when you start looking at gang statutes, it's a lot like looking at RICO because I think it's modeled on like federal RICO
Yeah.
statutes, very much the same concept. And what the definition of a criminal street gang in Georgia is any organization, association, or group of three or more persons associated in fact, whether formal or informal, which engages in criminal gang activity as defined in paragraph one. And criminal gang activity is basically a bunch of, like violating a bunch of criminal laws. And I can talk about that. But I think what happens, let me finish this. The existence of such organization, association, or group of individuals associated, in fact, may be established by evidence of a common name, common identifying signs, symbols, tattoos, graffiti, or attire, or other distinguishing characteristics, including but not limited to common activities, customs, or behaviors. Such term shall not include three or more persons associated, in fact, whether formal or informal, who are not engaged in criminal activity. Gang activity. So, if you're hanging out in the treehouse, that's not what we're talking about. But when a lawyer gets a gang case and they start looking at these statutes, I mean, they are lengthy, lots of paragraphs, lots of subsections. And when you start, the very first thing in the definitions is criminal, what is criminal gang activity? It starts out with any offense defined as racketeering activity. Any violation of the stalking law, rape, aggravated sodomy, there's murder, obviously, any violent crime, things involving guns. It's just an enormous laundry list of stuff that if you show people are doing this, that's gang activity. But there is also this idea that it has to be in furtherance of the gang. They've added in stuff like statutes have changed. They're constantly tweaking these things. So for lawyers, you've got to look at it over and over and over again. They've added in sex trafficking, which of course is a hot button issue right now. There's now a drive-by shooting statute that's separate that's in this code section, or not in this code section, but it's in the chapter on gangs. And there's a lot of stuff involving possessions of weapons, use of weapons. So when the first thing you see is this laundry list of stuff, but you don't see the criminal gang activity, like what is a gang? A lot of times people just shut the book and they're like, this is too much work and I don't want to do it. And I think that that's what happens with police officers too. Is that fair?
Yeah, and maybe not necessarily with the officers. You may have some good officers that want to put in the legwork, but it's the command staff and just like constantly putting out like the biggest fire that pops up, right? Where like, I mean, police is like short term, man. Like it's like what's in front of me? Like this is what the politics of policing have become. It's like what's in front of me? What's the most recent problem? Like I need to solve that right now. Like we don't have time for devoting manpower to all this, to your point, the manpower stuff. Like we don't have the number of officers, we're short. We don't have the number of officers to do a long-term gang investigation, or we don't have the manpower to put three people in a gang unit to actually like that's their only job, right? Like ideally that's what you would have. So like the homicide investigator doesn't have to spend all his time investigating a group. Like you should ideally have several people in your city that's their only job is to do these types of things, right? To get all this background information. So when the murder happens and the homicide guy's like, hey, this guy's claiming OTF, what do you know about him? And then it's like, nope, here you go. Here's your package. Like I've documented from a year ago to today. This is what I know. And like this is what I can tell you about it. These are all the crimes that they've done, right? Like that's kind of how that should work. But like people just no, we're short officers on the street. So I think command staff and leadership, depending on where you work, but I'd say a vast majority, it's very short term like outlook. It's not so much long term.
Yeah, and to your point, good chiefs of police, and you also had Jack Lumpton who came and wanted to really establish like an intel unit, wanted to he was willing. I remember he was working with the DA's office to create like gang intelligence, work on a gang database that we were trying to get that was multi-agency, those kinds of things. But the problem that you run into is that even with that, like say the sheriff's department is short on people, they aren't going to be inputting like the information they get from someone who gets arrested that has tattoos or whatever. They aren't going to be putting that in so that you can use that information. On the state level, the legislature has now like created funding for a gang database, you know, those kinds of things, which is great, but they aren't putting boots on the ground, right? So you still need for someone to document this. And I don't know that on the day-to-day, the agencies are really understanding, or people are really understanding how helpful it can be to shut down a gang.
Yeah.
Yeah, the end game is just we are going to shut this down and kind of make a statement like we aren't tolerating this in our community. Our community isn't about this. And
Or at the very least, you cut the head off the snake, right? Like you might have a group. This particular group had four people that were like the main leaders of the group. And once you took off two or three of them, like it kind of it went away. You know, I mean, I'm not going to say it just ceased to exist because it still did, but once you took out like some of the main players, like it kind of crumbles on itself, right? It's a house of cards.
So you're looking at the social media of Quezon Lee, Naquan Tanks, and Johnny Harris, and who was the fourth guy?
Daquan Bryant.
Okay. You're looking at their social media, and from the beginning, of 2015, you've got shootings, guns. Trading off guns. I think, am I correct that Quezon was still on an ankle monitor at this point in time?
At one point, yeah, he was like toward like the beginning of 2015, I think he was.
So he had been arrested, if I am correct, for something involving like an entering auto or a theft of a car or something like that in like, I don't know, October or November of 24.
14, I think.
I'm sorry, 2014. You are correct. I would love to blame this on cold medicine, but I can't. So he's there at his house, just like corroborating things that he is saying on his social media. Like, what is he saying that you're able to then find evidence to corroborate for, like very early on?
Like some of the stuff, like he'd be saying, well, it was kind of a mixed bag, but like one of the things I remember was like there was a burglary reported at Montgomery Landings, and there was like a PlayStation, some Jordans, a Louis Vuitton belt, some other stuff that was stolen. And then you like turn the page to social media for that day. And they got like a group chat going, and he's talking about how they hit a lick and sends a picture of like a pair of Jordans and like a Louis Vuitton belt. Like it was like exactly what was reported as stolen. Things like this. And then, you know, there was at one point, there was a stolen car in a pursuit. And so it was a shots fired, and then identifying a stolen car and then a pursuit. And Johnny Harris, I think, ended up getting arrested at that time, and one other kid. But then cross-referencing Quezon's social media, it's like him and Johnny Harris sitting in the stolen car with a showing a gun, and they're sending it to their friends, or their fellow gang members, and all of these types of things.
So, what does that mean to you as an investigator looking at this as a gang? The fact that they're sending pictures and messaging each other about the things that they have stolen, what they're going to do with them. What does that mean to you?
Well, it's clear like they're doing this stuff as a group with like right three or more people is kind of what you had mentioned. But also like one of the important things is some of the context behind some of those conversations too, right? When they're talking about they stole a gun, like they hit a lick and they got a gun. And one of the other kids is saying, "Oh, let me hold that or I'll buy that off of you." And then the one kid's like, I think it was maybe Naquan Tanks, and said something like, "Oh no, like we're not going to sell it to you." And then the kid who was trying to buy the gun was like, "Oh no, that's Quaison's gun, not yours." And then Quaison basically responded like, "Nah, little bro, it's all ours. Like, it's all our gun," or whatever. Basically saying like they're gonna share it. Like he's doing it right for the group. He's gonna share his gun. And then as you follow that conversation about that particular weapon, there's multiple conversations asking him if they can borrow the gun. And he's like, "No, these other people have it right now, but I'll get it to you." And so the gun is exchanging hands, and like that becomes super important because it's for the benefit of the group, right? It's not just I'm committing a crime and keeping the shit for myself. It's no, I'm committing a crime and we're gonna share this, and I'm gonna loan it to these other people to go do a shooting, and then I'm gonna get it back, and then I'm gonna give it to you so you can go do a shooting. And that stuff all became like super important.
Among the things that you talk about too, and I'm looking particularly at one of the things I indicted in this case, was an armed robbery of a Mantle lot, January 18th of 2015. What do you remember about that being like? Was there stuff in the social media that helped with that?
Yeah, there was. And when I was how I came across that investigation was that I was looking at the social media and looking at what they were talking about around that time, and him and Johnny Harris kept talking about wanting to go do robberies, and like, "Hey, we're gonna go do a robbery tonight." And then they're like, "Oh, why didn't you come by last night? You know, oh, we're gonna do it today." And then so like basically like that day they were saying they were gonna be doing a robbery. So then I cross-referenced our report system and I was like, "Did any robberies actually take place this day?" And like lo and behold, a Mantle lot had been robbed that day in daylight. And so I read, I don't think it was even assigned, because it was like,
That happened. It doesn't get assigned. What are we talking about?
well, there's so many armed robberies that I think they assign them by solvability factors. So like if you've got a known suspect, or if you've got forensic evidence, or if you've got traceable property or whatever, they might assign it, but otherwise they might not. So just because of the volume of armed robberies, and there's not enough investigators to work them all. So I don't think it was assigned to anybody, if I remember right, or if it was, it was pretty much closed out right away. But I ended up like reading the report to the initial officer and sort of the description she gave. And she said one was, they looked really young, one was tall, one was short, which rang a bell to me with the descriptions from Hakeem's case. And I was like, "Hey, one tall, one short." And like, yeah, like nothing ever really came of it. So I was like, "This is interesting," because they were talking about doing a robbery. Now this girl gets robbed. She's kind of giving physical description. So I ended up calling Amanda a lot, and I just talked to her and interviewed her, and I was like, "Hey, tell me as much as you can remember about that." And this was like 2017, I'm talking to her. So this was like 2 years later, over 2 years later. And she still gave a really good description. She described the short one as having dark skin, and described like seeing his eyes, and then she described the weapon too. I asked her to describe the weapon, and she said, "Well, it was like a square. Like it had a really square, like when you pointed it at me, it was like really square. Like I just remember it being had a it was like a very square looking weapon." And the photos that they're showing or passing along about this gun that they're sharing on social media at that time, it was a 380 with like a square
Muzzle.
muzzle, and very, very noticeably square, right? Like, you could
Yeah.
say, yeah, Glocks have a square, whatever. No, this was like a very squared off, like consistent with what she described. And at that time, she was living in California. So I had sent a photo spread because she said that she thought she might be able to remember, identify the person. So I had asked like the local agency to show her a photo spread, and she actually identified Quaison Lee in the photo spread. So that was like a robbery case we were able to make
Well,
after the fact.
she also described someone in a blue Adidas jacket, which is, there were pictures of Johnny Harris in a blue Adidas jacket in the social media. I mean, it doesn't mean that he was necessarily there, but it is the those
But if you
photos.
cross-reference the clothing with the fact that that's who he's talking to about going to do a robbery, right? I mean, you could
Right.
draw the conclusion that it was probably him, right?
And she thought that there were two other people acting as lookout, like
Lookouts,
further down the street. I mean, it is consistent with these four guys doing armed robberies, doing licks, just like they're saying they're doing.
right.
With a gun that they are clearly using.
Right.
So, you know, I felt like that was a pretty good case. And oddly, that got nullified by the present DA's office.
You're giving spoilers. You're giving spoilers.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm still angry.
Well, it becomes important to the murder, right? Because it's a similar criminal act, right? It's
right.
The same exact fucking thing that happened in the murder.
Right. They're trying to rob, you know, innocent guys in a parking lot with a gun, but for his own reasons, Quaison just started shooting before they even got very far along. Because what they took from Amantha Lott was her car keys.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of discussions about taking cars. Tell me about, like, some of the things that you were able to tie them to during this stretch of time. Because there's a ton of stuff in here. There's, like, actual audio in this Facebook.
Which yeah, I mean, there's, you, and you could see the progression too. And that's what, like, I thought was also important about the murder. It's like you almost from January to July, you can see like a buildup in criminal activity. Like, okay, the armed robbery in January was like a non-shooting armed robbery, but then, you know, you're progressing into more and more shootings, more and more violent discussions, more and more like threats of violence and actual shootings that they're doing. And you just see the progression. And I thought that was very potent in putting that timeline together. It's like, all right, you see that they're starting by like breaking into cars, breaking into houses to acquire weapons and property, and then using those as a means to commit other crimes like shootings and armed robberies, right? They're kids, so they don't have licenses, they don't have cars, so they're acquiring weapons, they're acquiring cars and other stuff to go commit other crimes. And then, like, you see the feuds with other groups, and in particular the audio you're talking about. Like, a lot of times they're sending each other audio messages over Facebook Messenger, and not like a live, like, video call, but like an audio record. You know, an audio,
like a voice message,
an audio message. Yep, and you send it over Messenger. Well, those were all retained, so like you can actually listen and hear all of those, and you had multiple audio files of different people, but one in particular where Quaison Lee was talking about how he really wanted to kill this other kid named Lavoris Morris, and that he was associated with the Grimy Boys. And he was talking about how he laid out how he was going to do it in this call. He said, like, he's going to put on a mask, knock on the door. He's going to use a revolver so there's no casings. And then his homeboys are going to be in the getaway car. Like, he outlined everything in an audio call that you could listen to that said like how he was going to commit this shooting and this murder. Fortunately, it didn't actually happen, but there were other shootings involving these guys and what have you. But that's the type of evidence that I was able to get through some of this gang investigation, which was like, even the mask, right? Like, he's talking about wearing a mask. Well, that's what they used when they did the armed robbery shooting of Hakeem Clark, right? They had masks. Like, it's all these things that are like little pieces, but they're all relevant because of what happened and how it happened.
Well, and there's even like some discussion that sounds like it's a drive-by shooting, like on MLK Day. Am I understanding? Like, they go and like they're beefing with somebody, and they go shoot at him at his house.
Shiree Smalls. Yeah. They went and shot up Shiree Smalls' house. Cause that was another group that they were beefing with at that point. And, yeah, I mean, it's just like you're it's endless almost of how much stuff, and that's just the stuff that, you know, we were able to find in social media and police reports. I mean, I'm sure there's other stuff that was not documented or wasn't talked about on the social media. Right.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, he doesn't actually, other than using the newspaper column about Hakeem Clark to try to get in with the Rolling Crips, there isn't really a direct reference to Hakeem's murder in here other than that.
No, he did. But one thing that was interesting, though, is that he did send, like, news articles of the other crimes he was doing. So, like, in March, I think he had been arrested when they were trying to do an entering auto, and he sent the news clipping to some friends during that incident. So, like, he had a habit of, like, sending news articles related to, like, his crimes. Like, he had a pattern of doing that is what I discovered as I was going through some of this stuff. So it made that reference to Hakeem's murder all that more relevant, because he was doing this type of thing before, like, for things that he was claiming. So that was important. But no, basically, like, after the murder, Quezon and the main four OTF people, they went with a guy, Charles Griffin, who was out of Chicago. They actually fled the state. They left Georgia and they went up to Illinois, and they were there for a couple of weeks.
What
before
was the
coming
relationship?
Back.
How did they know Charles Griffin?
I'm not sure how they met. I do know that Charles's daughter had association with OTF at that time, and so my belief is that they met through her. And he ended up taking them up to Chicago, and they did a bunch of shootings up in Illinois while they were up there.
Well, and is that reflected, some of that reflected in the social media as well?
Yeah. Yep. 100% it is. And, you know, there's police reports from up in Illinois talking about, you know, all of that. And so it was like, it was really, you know, I mean, you think about, typically somebody might flee the state to go lay low. Like, these guys fled the state to go do more shooting somewhere else. And it was kind of at the behest of Charles Griffin at that time. I think he was a gang member up from Chicago, and he was like, I think they looked at him as like an OG and were like learning from him and wanting to impress him and all this kind of stuff. And there were some messages later on when they got brought back, and Quezon was getting interviewed by me and Patrick Johnson about Hakeem's murder. Johnny Harris was talking to Charles's daughter and saying, oh, you know, O is going away for forever. You know, like, they're getting him with the murder. He said his fingerprints were found on the dead man's car. And the daughter was like, oh, well, Slim, that's her dad. Slim's going to be pissed. He had big plans for y'all and this kind of stuff. So it was clear he was sort of like an OG for them, that was sort of encouraging this behavior, I'll say.
Yeah. And of course, that's something that never got run down or prosecuted to my knowledge. Am I missing something?
No, in reference to that Illinois shooting, I did reach out to that local agency, and I was like, hey, I think I got the four suspects identified from this shooting. Do you want me to send you, you know, some photo spreads or whatever? And the guys up there were just kind of like, nah, don't worry about it. Like, can't force them, you know? And
yeah, I mean, I guess they don't care about shootings in Chicago. It's scary. It is scary. There's a conversation in here, and I kind of like this one. There's like a discussion between Naquan Tagson and, I guess, is it Daquan Bryant? They were talking about like who shooters are, and Nick, and like the only one in this group that was a wannabe is Naquan.
Yeah, they're saying,
I'm sorry.
That I think they were saying Daquan was a wannabe or something like that. I'd have to look at the thing again. But so yeah. they said Six is a shooter, and that's O. He goes also by Six. So they were saying O is a shooter, and then I forget who the other three were. But yeah, they were saying Johnny Harris wasn't a shooter. That's what they were saying. They were basically saying Johnny Harris wasn't a shooter. And Johnny was like, no, I shot somebody with O one time. And I forget what the response was, but it was something like that. But basically they were identifying who the shooters were in the group.
And Quezon Lee was always one of them.
Yeah, he was like the first one off rip, man.
And I remember getting this file and being duly impressed with all of the work that you put into it. Because again, you it is rare that you get a file that has it laid out for you like this. And yeah, it's hard to prosecute a gang case, but at the same time, it's not that hard when you have it handed to you, right?
Yeah, I always thought like you could pick and choose, right? Like you'd almost like cherry pick what you wanted to present, you know? Like there's so much of it that you could like it's so much you can't present at all. You just have to cherry pick what you want.
Right. And so in, you, when we're looking at the statutes, there are enhancements if someone has decision-making power, enhancements in sentencing. If someone in the gang, you can prove that they have decision-making power. There is stuff in the Facebook messages that would support that Quezon had decision-making power for who stayed in the gang and who was going to be put out. You've got the gun usage, him trying to get into another gang because he's on another level. You have the masks that you talked about, this armed robbery that of Amantha Lott. There's just a lot in there. The shootings, particularly the violence, the planning that went into, say, Lavoris Morris's the shooting that they wanted to do there, the murder. There's a lot to work with here. And I'm still like a bit lost as to why people are so afraid of it. It's the job, right?
Yeah, and it's the truth. You know
Yeah.
what I mean? Like it's
Yeah.
not like I will say that I've probably seen in my time just overall and not with you guys, but I've seen in my time like the stretch to make the gang case, right? Like the stretch to connect the gang to whatever the incident is, right? Like oh, let's he's a gang member, so let's make it about a gang case where it's not really. Well, it's like that's not the case here. Like this is all about gang activity. Like, and Hakeem's murder was all about gang activity. Like it was what they were living, and it was what they were living for. And
Right.
like that's the truth here. And so you can't extricate that out from what happened. Like you cannot remove the gang from what happened to Hakeem Clark because it was a driving and motivating factor to why it even happened in the first place. And so to me, they're so intertwined that like it's just the truth, right? So to sit there and say, oh, we're not going to consider the gang aspects of this case. Well, that's an injustice, right? Like that's an
Yeah.
injustice not only to the victim, but it's also an injustice to the jury who's entitled to understand the truth about what this is, right? Like the truth about what happened and to make their decision based on full information of like the truth. And so yeah, I don't know, I just it, this was a case where yeah, it's not like we're not stretching anything here. Like that's just the
No.
truth of what these guys were and what they were doing.
Right. So I think that part of the confusion for prosecutors maybe is that they're looking at all of this social media and thinking, oh, well, some of it's hearsay because this person's not going to testify, but we've made other gang cases. And the law is essentially if you're a co-conspirator and you are making statements in furtherance of the conspiracy, in other words, in furtherance of the gang being a criminal act is in itself a crime. So anything you do in furtherance of the gang, any statement you make in furtherance of the gang is admissible as a co-conspirator statement. And I think there's,
Not only that, Christy, but we did have cooperators in this case too. I'm
yeah,
not going to go into that, but like
no,
we had
but we did.
cooperators that identified these people, identified the members, identified their decision-making power, the structure, the acts, identified criminal acts that they did. And so it's not, we're not just relying on that either. Like we had direct witnesses that could provide context related to this gang.
Right. And like you said, and this is one of the things too, that the courts are a little skittish about gang stuff these days too. And there seems to be sometimes a disconnect with the appellate courts. Like I think there was an opinion in Georgia recently talking about rap lyrics aren't necessarily gang related and you have to do more to make that admissible. Those kinds of things make judges sitting on the bench skittish about admitting gang stuff. And I think we have all seen the case where, oh, he's a gang member and he beat up his girlfriend, so let's charge, this domestic violence case with as a gang charge, which you really, and like you said, you have to make that connection. Is this in furtherance of the gang? Is this something that was in fact something that they were going to profit from? Like the armed robbery of Hakeem and his friends was something that they were going to profit from. And we know from their social media and from, what testimony there would have been that that's what they did. They pooled everything that they got in armed robberies. So we're not guessing. And I think that that's part of it too. Like when I call somebody like you as a gang expert, I need for you to express to me how you know that something is gang material. And just training and training, like you go to a training and they told you about Nine Tray Gangsters, and I saw some PowerPoint slides, may not be enough on its own. But I don't think that you or I have ever presented a case like that. It usually involves something a little more concrete, like you have sat down and spoken with someone who can tell you that in this moment, Quezon Lee was in only the family and this was the structure, right? And that's kind of what you need. Or some document, like, and for reasons, and I've seen this in a couple of cases at least, like they have the little spiral notebook where they just kind of write out like who's who in the gang and who's moving up and all of those things. If you do the work, that evidence exists. It exists somewhere.
Yeah, like we didn't have the male roster, but we had the female roster because they sent it over social media. So we had a picture of the OTF female roster in this case. Like, so the, all that stuff, it exists. And as far as like gang cases go, this and probably Foley were the two probably strongest gang cases I've been a part of. There was one case I worked up here that was also a really strong gang case, but
I think Arthur Newton's up there too. Arthur Newton's up there.
But I didn't do a lot of the gang stuff with that case. Like I did a little bit, but I was kind of peripherally involved just in the initial armed robbery. John Garcia and Pujala, I think, did most of the other gang stuff on that one. But
But yeah, so you had one. You've had what, two and a half down here that you would say have good gang evidence, and you had one up there. Was that connected? I know that you've done extensive work on that gang case, and that just popped up in the middle of a murder investigation. Is that right?
yeah, it was the same type of thing where, you're investigating a case and then you're kind of delving into like the people and like the motive, right? Like it's always, we don't have to prove motive as part of a prosecution, but like that kind of sucks for the jury. Like the jury wants to understand why did this happen, right? And we may never answer that in a lot of cases, but if we can answer that, we fucking should. And so like it became part of that investigation as far as like explaining why it happened. Even with Hakeem's case, right? Like it's not as simple as just like, oh, it's an armed robbery. It's like, no, it's an armed robbery that happened because these people are in a gang and this is what they do and this is what they were out for, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't just like it was an opportunity, but it was also a planned, right? Like thing that they always do. Like they were out looking to do this. So it becomes an important explanatory factor in a lot of these cases. And I will say, like, Yeah, I don't think I'm a gang expert for every case that there is, but a lot of the cases that I've worked that have a gang dynamic, like you have to become that in order to really explain the incident and the actions of the actors.
And that requires, knowledge like in the moment, like that snapshot of what's happening with that gang in that period of time of the crime that you're trying to prosecute.
Correct.
I love that you mentioned motive because, again, from a prosecutor's perspective, motive is pretty much always admissible. Like it is the kind of thing, there are exceptions about it in what we call 404B law. 404B is usually for any extraneous criminal or bad act on the part of a defendant. Usually those things don't come in unless it is related to motive. And when you have a gang case like this, and that is the motive, those extraneous things, the other shootings, come in. So again, as a lawyer, there is a lot that happens in a gang case that you might be intimidated by, you might be a little uncertain on how to argue, but the law is out there and it can help you. And I get upset when we are ignoring evidence that's there. You're leaving it on the table.
Yeah.
So, like for this gang, and I know, we are kind of coming to the end of the discussion of it. What happened with OTF after you arrested Quezon for this murder? Do you know?
Well, OTF in Savannah started to kind of die off a little bit more towards the end of 2015 because Naquan Tankson ended up getting arrested for an armed robbery. Daquan Bryant ended up getting arrested for a shooting in Yamacraw. So you took two main players off the board, and then Johnny Harris ended up getting arrested for something else, and then he ended up getting a bunch of other stuff. So he was off the map too for a while. And so Quezon was kind of out there by himself. And I won't say OTF didn't exist, but it started to. I mean, you got three out of four of the main players were off the grid for a long time, and then Quezon ended up getting popped later on. But during that time, and it's my my opinion that that's part of the reason why he was looking to get in with the rolling 60s Crips is because he was starting to kind of feel like this is a man that has enemies, right? Like he's doing a lot of these shootings and things like this, and now he's kind of, I'm not going to say without support, but his main boys are gone. So now he's got to click up with somebody else. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing as he's drifting towards those rolling 60s and trying to get in with them is that he's looking to click up with a new group so he can maintain status and he can maintain his lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it was after that ramp up. And then, they started getting arrested for more significant crimes. And then, after Quezon was arrested, I'm sure it deteriorated even more after that. But I don't say it ceases to exist because it probably still had maybe changed or assimilated into something else or whatever, but it certainly wasn't the same as it was in 2015.
And those other YNIC splinters, we've talked about OTM 1100. They
Yep.
went on to do other stuff, right?
Yeah.
And we've talked about Jerry Chambers and some of those other cases that touch on that. So when we were talking about cutting the head off the Hydra, what's the point? What are we trying to do with this gang?
Well, I think like the important recognition is that it's not right, it's not novel knowledge, but there's a high percentage of violent crime that's done by a relatively small number of people. And if you can identify those people, they're worth working and worth looking to put away, right? I mean, like again, like you're talking about somebody who's young that just killed somebody that fled the state not to get caught, but also not to lay low, went to go commit other shootings. Like, this person has no, and even in the messages, like, you know, he's known as a shooter. He has no, like, remorse about doing a shooting. Like, it's like eating breakfast for him. So it, you know, it's just like, that's a person we don't really want out here on the streets with the rest of us, because he's just looking to hurt people and doesn't care.
Well, and he's also encouraging other people, right? So, like,
right.
Because, and when you look at the social media for this case in context, you have somebody who's been a leader in the gang, he's been a shooter, he's violent, but he's also somebody who relies on others. Like, he likes to have minions. He likes to have, you know, support, like you said, it supports his lifestyle, like money coming in, you know, having guns to trade off so that it's harder to find him. He is used to and wants to have people who do that for him. Like, it's evident even before we knew that Charles Griffin existed, that he's kind of wanting to be a leader, like wanting to be a leader in this context. And so yes, him back out on the street, what's he going to be doing, right?
Yep, same thing.
Same thing. He's going to be training up young guys to, you know, like, support him, protect him when he's going to shoot people, all of those things. I mean, that it's not like we're getting rid of the violent crime problem by ignoring the violent crime problem.
Right. And to me, that's like the biggest thing is, like, you know, identifying the most violent, the people that are doing the most violence in the community, and then holding them account for what they're doing and trying to improve and make the community a safer place. Like, ultimately, that's what we're trying to do.
Right. Make people feel like they're safe going outside, or, you know, they aren't going to have their car keys robbed from them, or their car's not going to be stolen, or, you know, because all of those things, from the small to the huge, were in this social media for this gang.
Yeah, and not even just feeling safe, like actually being safe, like actually being able to go out and not be robbed, and, you know, so yeah.
Right. So but, we're go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just going to say, like, you know, as we were talking about Jerry Chambers and this case, one of the things that I kind of wanted to mention briefly was just sort of like the failure of, like, the juvenile system to really prevent any of this stuff from happening. There was opportunities in this case, and there were opportunities in the Chambers case, like, where these things could have been preventable, man, if there was greater accountability in that system. You know, I think Quezon Lee alone may have been 3 or 4 times was arrested from January to July, where, okay, a lot of it was property crime related stuff, but still, like, you know, it only emboldened him, in my opinion. Just even, like, we talked about his interview last time, like, he had been caught several times and not once ever had a consequence other than his ankle monitor, which he didn't really give a shit about, right? So, like, it only emboldened him to, like, just think that he could do it more, he could do it harder, and nothing would ever happen, right? Like, there was just no consequence for him.
And so far, there still hasn't really been. So, yeah, that is a conversation for the next or the last episode on this case. But you're right. And I think, you know, I've done some work in the juvenile system, primarily not criminal work, but you see this idea that, oh, we can save you, right? But it's like disciplining your own children. You know, you have to have consequences or they will keep doing the thing that they can get away with and think it's funny, right?
Right. Right.
And again, you know, there's an element of that in this too. It's like, oh, you know, I'm going to keep shooting. I'm going to keep doing whatever. It's like they really, you know, I just need to get off this ankle monitor and we'll go do a lick. It's not stopping the problem and it's not getting their attention. All it is doing is maybe putting a little road bump in there, maybe.
Yeah. And, like, you know, I'm not saying, like, rehabilitation doesn't work. Like, you know, I think there's a time and a place for that kind of stuff, but there also should be some kind of other screening methods where, I mean, you can identify the, you can identify the ones that are just don't care about, you know what I mean? Like that aren't trying to do better, or they're the ones doing the violent crime. Like we should have a different, I think we should have a different path for people like that. But that's just my opinion and what I've seen over the years in my career. And so I think there's a place for rehabilitation, but I also think there's a place for not having people out free in our society that are just out there to hurt people.
Well, right. And you see that particularly, let's talk, just mention Jerry Chambers. We talked about it in the episodes about him, but as a juvenile, he is robbing an elderly person at the mall, or trying to, and couldn't prove that anything was actually taken. So it was not counted as an armed robbery, just a
Right.
shooting. But he shot this older woman going to her car in an armed robbery or attempted armed robbery. And that, because it was not a successful armed robbery, and the law again has changed in Georgia just this year that a shooting now can be handled as an adult thing.
That's good. That's a good thing.
It is a good thing, but it's, what, 10 years too late for Jerry Chambers.
Yeah. Yep.
But he goes in and he gets a slap on the wrist. Oh, poor him. I mean, that really is the approach that you see a lot of times, like, oh, we're trying to fix you, we're trying to fix you. That some of these kids, and Quaison certainly one of them, you can see in his social media, don't want it.
Yep.
So we are, as a society, we've got to do better. Are there any things that you would recommend need to be done about gangs in any law enforcement environment before we sign off?
I just think that they shouldn't be ignored. I think that you should have people dedicated to doing a good, thorough job and establishing what your the landscape or your communities, right? Like every community is going to be different. The gangs that are active are going to be different in every community and ever changing. So it's really something that needs to be a full-time attention getter. And like yeah, it's just it needs, especially in any urban environment, but even in some of these rural communities, it's just as rampant. But almost in every urban community, I would say it's needed. So I don't know. I kind of think I said what I thought the best approach might be, but other than that, no, just don't ignore it. And if you're a violent crime investigator and you come across it, you don't ignore that stuff because it can be critical. It might just be information, it might just be intel, but it also could be something that really enhances your case and gives a motive or, allows for a full picture to be painted.
Yeah, I agree with you. We've got to be doing better, and doesn't look like we are. At least we didn't in this case, and that is something I want to talk about, because despite all of your hard work, this case didn't end up in justice for Hakeem or his family, and that's wrong. So thank you. I appreciate it, and we'll be
Thank you.
talking. Only the family is just one of many street gangs that splintered off from homegrown Savannah gangs. These criminal street gangs seek to terrorize this town. Is OTF gone? As you've heard, gangs don't disappear, they morph. Can they ever be truly gone if prosecutors and law enforcement refuse to hold gang members accountable as a group? We are not done shedding light on how the prosecution of Quezon Lee is one of many examples of cases where the DA's office dropped the ball by not presenting the evidence it was given. It will be a couple of weeks before we are able to delve into the catastrophic failure of this murder prosecution. Hold tight.